Group Summer School at the Cenacle, Greyshot, Saturday morning, 11th April, 1981. Man has always, and particularly during the last 6,000 years or so, been curious about the ultimate origin of everything. Much speculative thought has produced all kinds of theories on this matter. Theories which were based not upon a transcendent vision and understanding of reality, but upon the activity of their own ordinary thought processes. These, we who are interested in religion in the profound sense, may discard. There were those, however, who, through the religious discipline, the complete purification of the psyche and the mind, were capable of becoming aware in a profound sense, far profounder than what we mean by the word consciousness. They became aware in a very profound sense of this origin of things and its development into the one total reality, which is the whole universe. These were the great founders of the religions and the true great spiritual teachers, amongst whom the great mystics of the world, whether they belonged to one faith or another, gave some of the most wonderful teachings. Now, these teachings were expressed in concepts and words which were appropriate to the time in which they lived and the land in which they flourished. The external circumstance and the nature of physical things has always had a very considerable influence upon the formulation of the profoundest perceptions. But what is so interesting is that none of the founders of the religions erred on the side of producing a system of philosophy. They taught human beings how they should live in order that is to say, live fully humanly, in order that they themselves could become utterly purified and therefore become the receptacles of the energy of transcendence to enter into them freely and flow out of them as freely for the benefit of those around them, and therefore also of all mankind. So the formulation in the different religions is a formulation appropriate to the people, the country, and the times in which they flourished. After all the great religions of the world, right up to the time of Muhammad, arose in a particular part of the world. And whilst it is true that the vitality of those teachings was so great that it overflowed the boundaries of their own country and helped people elsewhere too, those teachings are specifically teachings which are appropriate for those people, those times, and their particular milieu. Today, we live in what is commonly understood as a scientific age. And the ultimate of things, the origin of things, needs new language, so to say. Whereas formerly, everything was presented either in terms of a divine being, a personal God, or an impersonal unknown, unknowable power, but a power which was somehow conscious as such. Today we can talk in terms of energy, and I'm using the word energy with this proviso. Whereas we know in our physical world what we mean by electrical or gravitational or heat or light energy, what energy in itself is, as an aseity, a self-subsistent ultimate reality, we know nothing whatsoever. So it is as convenient a word as God or Brahman or Atma or Ahura Mazda or Allah. It is as convenient a word to use in modern times as those old personalistic words were in ancient times. Now, if we look into the deeps of the religious teachings of all the great religions, we find the origin as the power which brought forth the universe. Today we can talk perhaps somewhat along these lines. The primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy is also simultaneously pure or absolute consciousness, and its state is completely blissful. It's in a state of unmanifestation. This energy differentiates in course of time as if it wakes up from a state of quiescence. The ultimate meaning of chaos is not disorder, it is this energy in a state of vibrant quiescence, waking up, so to say, out of this state of quiescence. The undifferentiated energy begins to differentiate, and at the same time the pure absolute consciousness begins to proliferate as the differentiation, the differentiated forms of energy come into being. So we have this double line of development. But there, although it is a double line, they don't run parallel to each other. They are completely interwoven with each other. This is what we must bear in mind. And this brings about various grades of being and manifestation. Grades of being which we cannot conceive of with our thinking powers, because we would immediately picture them as different things, as particular manifestations throughout the entire cosmos. We have to just sort of feel what these grades of beings could be. Perhaps we may express these grades of being. Remember, they are pure energy and pure consciousness still. We can talk of them in terms of archetypal forms of the manifestation, different archetypal forms of the manifestation of this primordial creative energy and of the absolute consciousness, the ultimate consciousness. These grades of being are accessible to human beings, provided human beings live in such manner that their complete purification renders their own psyche, their own mind, as we might say, completely transparent to this light of transcendence. And when that is the case, and the person who experiences these has to tell others what it is like, he uses terms like archangels, angels, and so forth in the Judeo-Christian traditions, and terms like devas, rather unfortunately translated as gods, devas, the shining ones, some translate them as, and the suras and the asuras, the constructive forces, the destructive forces, which bring about the entire universal process. Now, when I say destructive, do not think of destruction in the sense of absolute annihilation. There is no such thing as absolute annihilation. But there is the absolute existence as such. The existence part undergoes change all the time. There is that which corresponds transcendentally to this existence part. Bear in mind the meaning of the word existence. Ex out of, sistere, to stand. A standing out of. It is because the great teachers experienced this in actual awareness, the profoundest awareness man can possibly have. They regarded the existence part as mortal, and the eternal, infinite and immortal part as transcendent, and separated the two. This, it seems, is actually a mistake. One should not separate the two. The existence part, which is finite, temporal and mortal, is completely subsumed in the infinite, the eternal and the immortal. Out of the immortal, there issues the mortal. And immortality is experienced by the purified being in terms which I like to express as immortality rides on the wings of mortality. Just as eternity rides on the wings of time. So now, when this differentiation process becomes greater and greater, it ultimately ends up in its concretest manifestation as what we call matter. Now, consciousness, pure consciousness, gets locked up and limited as these grades of being come into existence. And in what we call solid matter, it is in its most imprisoned state. But do bear in mind that it is transcendence itself which is manifesting in this manner. Consciousness is most locked up in the mineral kingdom, as we know. It is beginning to develop in the animal kingdom. And, of course, in the human kingdom. The human species, on this planet anyway, has consciousness developed to the highest degree on this planet. Now, this consciousness distinguishes us mortals, us human beings, most considerably from, distinguishes us very much from all other states of animate existence. This consciousness is an expression and activity of what we may call mind. And mind, in its actuality, is that type of, that archetypal form of the ultimate creative energy which releases the shaped and formed cosmos out of the primordial chaos, which, remember, is vibrant quiescence and not disorder. Do remember that. I think if one studies the Greek poet Hesiod fairly intimately, fairly deeply, one will see all these points. Just as the word Eros does not, has less relationship in actual fact to the word erotic than to that ultimate love which brings forth and binds all things together. You have the same in the Indian teachings. Karma, K-A-M-A, remember, Kama is the god of love as such. And there are the two aspects clearly presented. The aspect which corresponds to the erotic and the aspect which corresponds to the creative energy at work and sustaining everything through the binding power, that is to say the relating and sustaining power of love in its profoundest sense. Kama really means that, because Kama is said to be the creator of the gods, of the devas. Don't translate them as gods, because the English word god has a very specific meaning which does not apply to the term deva as such. So, consciousness in us is a factor of very great importance. Our theme, as you know, is on living humanly. If we are to live humanly in the full sense, we must understand clearly what is implied in our consciousness and how it is to be developed and so forth. You know how in Genesis it is said that in the Garden of Eden were planted in the middle of the garden two trees. How can you have two trees in the middle of the garden? You see, the tree of life and the tree of good and evil. Now consider it this way, which might be helpful. The fruit of the tree of life is consciousness. And if that fruit is eaten and remains utterly pure in him who eats it, his consciousness can touch the divine. That is the fruit of the tree of life, this kind of consciousness as such. It is not consciousness in our ordinary sense of consciousness, which is a discriminative consciousness. Ours is an analytical, separative, and therefore sinful consciousness. The original sin is this consciousness which divides things up and spoils the unity of the universe. Whatsoever hurts or spoils the unity of the universe is sin, the breaking up of the wholeness, the holiness. So it is not our ordinary discriminative consciousness. It is a mode of awareness which, as far as the brain is concerned, is an unknowing awareness. How do we know things? Only by separating, by analyzing. We break things up into bits and then we synthesize them. The brain does all that. But mind is immensely profounder than brain, immensely greater than brain as such. And consciousness is that aspect and activity of mind which enables one to experience reality as reality, which we may call ultimate truth, but which defies conceptualizing and verbalizing. So you see, all that we talk about, all that we write about, whilst it can be inspiring and so forth, is after all just so much material which comes into being, has its span of life, and then dies. It belongs to the realm of mortality and finitude, of limitation, and therefore the realm of sorrow, suffering, sin, misery, and all of that. But our consciousness as such has that sort of spark, that element in it, which can rise to the supreme heights and touch divinity, be in touch, as in Christian terms, with the Father in heaven. You see? Now, how shall we understand, how shall we approach this consciousness? Remember, it's not analytical. It's not something that splits up. And it is also not something that mechanically synthesizes. Do distinguish very clearly between mechanical synthesis, which the brain carries out, and living integration, which is true growth, which mind in its purity and perfection for which mind in its purity and perfection is the instrument. And this is what we may say in simple English terms, God given to us. There is transcendence embodied in us as such. We have this power of choice. Here in Zarathustrian teaching, it starts, Zarathustra's first sermon explains how the twin aspects of the mind are present in us. One aspect which is the Holy One, which leads us to the divine ultimately. And the other aspect is the evil one. Now this evil aspect is experienced by the whole human race in terms of its isolative and separative consciousness. Consider the very simple fact. We are very conscious of ourselves. Number one, I am. The concept I am I and not you, which is the great sin. That concept emerges shortly after birth because people around us talk to us in a manner which evokes this sense of separate individual existence as such. That is how it comes into being. But the I am I is an illusion. There is only the absolute one total reality of which the individual being is an integral part and parcel. Now, our task consists in getting free of this separative and isolative I am I consciousness. So we are conscious that way. And it is that which is the, and all the rest of the world, the rest of mankind, the rest of the universe is the not self. This is the self and the rest is the not self. Just spend plenty of time quietly letting the mind be quiet and meditating upon this matter. And you will be surprised to discover how intensely alive our self-consciousness is, how intensely dull and weak our not-self-consciousness is. Everything else, the total universe is the not-self. I am I is very intense. What a disproportion. Conceit? What a conceit. It is a fanciful notion that I am I separate from you or the rest of the universe. But that is the way in which I am aware of our relationships. And therefore our relationships are in all likelihood going to be relationships of conflict, of disharmony. Because the not-self is something which we consider as hostile to our interests very often, most often. You remember how Lord Kelvin in the last century, towards the end of the last century, great scientist as he was, declared that the universe in which we live is a hostile universe. And the root of this hostility is this false sense of the separateness of oneself from everybody else and from everything else. The self and the not-self is the fundamental root of man's wars, difficulties, conflicts, sorrows, illnesses, and so on. This is the fundamental root of it all. When that consciousness gets changed, purified, and one begins to wake up to the relationship with everything that exists, then one is beginning to become healthy, whole, and can touch ultimately holiness as such. This is of extreme importance. What is the origin of this separative consciousness? After we are born, remember that the human body has a natural pleasure-pain mechanism in it as it functions. If it did not have a pleasure-pain mechanism, the body would not survive very long. the pain mechanism of the body tells us what to be cautious about, to beware of. The pleasure mechanism tells us that this is all right for bodily existence. But now, this mechanism has its psychical counterpart. I experience a pleasant sensation. What happens? I like it. I want more of it. I experience an unpleasant sensation. I dislike it and I want to get rid of it or destroy the source of the displeasure. You see how it happens. The attachment gives rise to greed, the aversion gives rise to hate, fear, anxiety, and all the rest of it. That is the origin. The psychical counterpart is the one which we have to consider and control. Nature will bring the physical organism to maturity in the ordinary process of growth. And this process of growth, do remember, always involves the immediate living process as also the immediate dying process. Growth means that the new state, which we call the grown state, has come into being because the old state has died. And in its dying, it has released the new state. So life-death is an inseparable unity. As you know, I have always called this not life-death, the life-death pulse of creation or of existence, but the life, other life pulse. Look at it that way, and you will see that the eternity of life, eternal life, is a fact, is a reality. It manifests through time in terms of succession, a succession which our imperfect perceptions and our impure psyches sense and describe as life and death. But it's life and other life all the time. This is how then this sense of the separate I comes into being. I feel, I want, I desire, I wish. My will, not thine, O Lord. That is how we do live. Very good. Now if this is the case, then we have, if we mean to live truly humanly, because the human being is an apparatus for divinity itself, for the transcendent to manifest. If you would like to use Buddhistic terms, for the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, to come to fruition through the born, the become, the made. When the born, the become, the made ceases to be an obstruction to the transcendent, then there is nothing but sorrow and suffering. In a sense, all existence is suffering. All existence. The pleasurable and as well as the joyful. It is all suffering simply because existence, as I suggested a few moments ago, is that which stands out of. It stands out of transcendence. And the purpose, the great purpose of human consciousness is that it will become fully aware of all these things, become completely purified, and therefore the holy grail, if you like, the vessel for the divine, for the transcendent, for the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. And that is the meaning of nirvana too. So the question arises, how do we proceed? What do we do about it? As we have just tried to see, our pleasure-pain mechanism is an indispensable for bodily existence. But our psychical response to the pleasure-pain mechanism is the thing that we have to deal with. Nature brings the body to perfection, to maturity and to perfection, unless, of course, we live so foolishly and unwisely, out of sympathy with nature's laws, that we become ill and suffer and so on. Now, the psyche is our problem. Nature hands over to us as far as the development of the psyche is concerned. The psyche, as you know, is dualistic. that dualism, pleasure, kind, cruel, generous, mean, all that sort of thing, that dualism is the state in which the psyche functions, until one begins to wake up to the fact that there is total and complete relationship between us as individuals and the great individual, the one and only individual. And remember how the word individual means the indivisible. So you will see that there are two aspects to our individuality. One is to realize individuality, indivisibility, which means wholeness, holiness, completeness within the limits of the particular person. The limits of the ego itself. Then there is the other individuality. Having realized that, assuming that we do and can realize that, having realized that, we have to release the greater, the profounder individuality, the indivisibility between oneself and the transcendent, the source and origin of everything. Now we can't release that by desiring to release it. Having realized individuality in the limited sense of the personal being, we have to let transcendence step into the field now. We have to let God do the work. You have to be quiet, do no work. You get a permanent pension. You see? And that means that we have to get free of the egoistic misconception of the ego. When we look at nature, for instance, how do we see it? We look out into that garden and see the beauty of it, the marvel of it, the lovely trees. We see each tree as a separate tree, true enough. But do we grant it a permanent separateness as such? Or do we see it as a whole garden consisting of so many trees and lawns and all the rest of it? We see it, or tend to see it, in terms of its wholeness. Now if we can see ourselves in that same spirit of wholeness and totality, we will see that we are wholly and totally related to the transcendent reality, the one total reality. And if our whole consciousness is turned inside out, so to say, a turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness has to take place, as it is put in Mahayana Buddhism. When that happens, then the sense of transcendence begins to awaken in us. But we have to beware. When the sense of transcendence first awakens in us, the age-long hereditary gift which we have through our human evolution during the last 3 or 4 million years or whatever it is, makes us associate the I with transcendence. I am the transcendent. Beware of that. I am just as no thing. I do not say nothing. As no thing in the presence of the transcendent. An integral part and parcel, true enough. But let transcendence be the ruler. Let not egoism, the egoistic misconception of self, interfere with that. Otherwise, like Lucifer, one will go to the permanently warm place. This is of great importance, because when one falls from the early stages of spiritual development, and sometimes even the later stages, Lucifer was the brightest star in the firmament, in the heavenly firmament. The fall is terrific. And it's very, very destructive. So this sense of transcendence awakens. And when that awakens, one has to give oneself wholly and totally to that. I am no thing, which represents embodied transcendence. But as in terms of separate existence, I am nothing. Because this psychophysical organism, which is the separate manifestation of the one transcendent reality, is perishing all the time. And it will never live forever and ever. Even the great founders of the religions, they all died. Every one of them. All the perfected holy ones who have lived on the globe, they all lived, they taught, they helped their people, and they died physically. The psychophysical organism is completely the perishable part. The immortal part is the infinite itself. We talk in terms of my immortal soul, or my God, or my Atma, and so forth. This is a mistaken way of talking and thinking. How can I parcel out a portion of the infinite, or the eternal, or the immortal, and claim possession of it? It has granted itself to this organism, and manifests through this organism in its own way, which is mysterious, wonderful, and quite beyond all clever chatter. We must realize that. If we really see that, then the conflict between conceit on the one hand, pride and so forth, and the conflict with humility ceases. One is then truly humble, but not humiliated. Because the divine, the one true, one total reality, the truth itself, has come to life in us. We are the instruments of it. Now this is the great purpose of consciousness. Consciousness is the fruit of the tree of life. And when consciousness awakens in this manner, one actually experiences the fact, which is expressed in phrases like the waters of eternal life. You will find in the Rig Veda, you will find in the Psalms, in the Bible, you will find this sort of thing expressed in most beautiful terms, beautiful poetic language, which is the only possible language to use in connection with that which is the divine, which is transcendent. Sit by the still waters, and in the stillness and silence of the self, the unity between what we commonly call self and not self is realized, and in that realization there is the complete fulfillment. Now, the word human, what does it mean? Its root is the Sanskrit man. And if you look in the Sanskrit dictionary, you will find just the common garden meaning of it. Man means to think. Does it? Is that the root from which we come? What do you and I mean by thinking? Our thinking is just a stream of silent chatter. Verbal chatter. And if you spend even 5 minutes just looking at this verbal chatter, you will feel rather uncomfortable and unhappy. 3 times in every sentence, the word I will occur. You can bet your bottom dollar on that. You see? And a short sentence too. As regards the long sentences, oh, the I has just blown up into the infinite ego, the egoistic ego. This is the kind of thing which we call our thinking. And we are always thinking about ourselves, about what we wish to have, what we want to do, about this pleasure or that pleasure. Examine all your... We should examine all our fantasies, our daydreams. They are a wonderful source of instruction, revealing to us just what we as psychophysical organisms here are. And we will be rather shocked, to put it gently. And again, beware of that sort of self-examination, self-observation, because if you do it too intensely, out of season, so to say, too quickly, you will be so shocked that you might want to commit suicide and put an end to it. I have met people who, after one of my lectures, particularly in Holland, a young man came up to me and said, if what you say is true, then I just must commit suicide, I must die. I said, well, you won't have any chance to do the right thing which you think ought to be done, you see, if you die. It's only you, the living person, who can do it. So be sensible, go and have a good meal and be happy about it. But you know, that young man burst into tears. He was weeping violently on my shoulder as he said those things. It was a terrible experience for me too, a somewhat frightening experience. What truths to give out and what not to. Remember, in the Upanishads, it is always said by the teacher to the disciple, do not give out the sacred teaching to the unworthy one, to one who has no devotion to the Supreme, and so forth. And Jesus' words, cast not your pearls before swine, for they will trample upon them and turn and rend you for giving that which should not be given. Use discretion in these matters. However, it is essential in the process of our human development to spend time becoming well aware of what we really are like. When we really see that we are ill in our psyche, ill in ourselves, unless we acknowledge that we are in a sinful state, a state of disharmony with the totality, with God, where that we are in that state, we can't even begin to go to the doctor to heal us. If you don't acknowledge your disease, there is no possibility to heal you. You have to acknowledge the disease in order to go to the doctor at all. So, who is the doctor now who will heal? It is that element of that aspect of transcendence which is embodied in us. That will instruct. You can choose to have that instruction from the founders of the great religions, whatever the faith to which you belong. From that source too, you can get the instruction. But do remember, when you get instruction from outside, you hear words or you read words and thoughts which you interpret with your particular mind, which is a heavily conditioned mind which almost invariably misinterprets what is being presented to you. The truths are terribly misinterpreted. Again and again this has happened, and this is why the followers of the great religions of the world have fallen so badly from the teachings of their great teachers, and there have been wars and cruelties and all sorts of evil doing in the name of God and the name of religion, which is one of the most tragic things in man's history. So now, if one grows in self-knowledge, if one remains quiet, one gradually becomes selfless. not unselfish, because unselfishness is something which we intellectually impose against our selfishness. This means conflict in the psyche. Don't do that. Don't fight the evil. Don't try to overcome evil. We have to heal the evil, make it whole. What can you throw out of the cosmos? It is all in the cosmos, all the time. If you push evil aside, it is still there. It will affect somebody else or something else. Understand it fully. We have the power of paying perfect attention. This is our instrument of salvation. If we pay perfect attention to whatsoever we call evil and whatsoever we call good, both the good and the evil becomes transformed. That energy gets released into a transcendent energy, which is the divine energy. That divine energy is infinite. It's eternal, it's immortal. It cannot be more, it cannot be less. The infinite means the immeasurable. So you see, that kind of transformation, perhaps one may almost call it a transmutation, takes place in one's own being. And then the flow between the divine and oneself, between the Father and the Son, is uninterrupted. There is a continual relationship. You can use the language of any of the great religions. You will find that this kind of thing has been taught throughout them all. So, if we do that, then we begin to understand what is meant by the word human. Man, the root man, as I said, is given out in the dictionary as to think. But it is not thinking in our terms. If you look into all the great religious teachings regarding the creation of the universe, the emergence of the universe, you will find that the actual material manifestation has been preceded by what, in perfectly sensible terms, has been called the thought in the mind of God. I'm using the word God because it is a nice, simple, short word, rather than using any long philosophic phrase or anything. The thought in the mind of God. What sort of a mind has God? Transcendence, which is infinite, eternal, immortal. What sort of a mind has it? Has it got a brain like we have? It hasn't. That mind, as I said earlier, is the archetypal form of the primordial creative energy and the absolute consciousness, which releases the entire universe, the visible and the invisible universe, into being. That is the mind. And the thought in the mind means the release of a shape, a form for manifestation, which with increasing concretization becomes what we see as the universe. Spirit is the subtlest form of this creative energy. Matter is the concretest form of this same creative energy. Look at it that way, and it will help you to be free of many illusions and delusions on this matter. So the thought in the mind of God is the original word. You see, our languages are so deficient. Well, inevitably they are deficient because our experience is limited to the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. Therefore, all our languages can only express things in terms of their separateness, in terms of their mortality, and so forth. There is no spoken sound which corresponds to this word in this transcendent sense, the creative word. You have it in the Judaic teachings, the ma'amar, the creative sound. You have in India the om, the sound om of the Hindus. These are all symbolic terms. The actuality is something which you can sense as and when the sense of transcendence awakens, but it is a sense which can never be expressed in words, in concepts and so on. Do remember that. So this thought in the mind of God is the meaning of the word logos. In the beginning was the word. And of course, beginning means is a word which applies only in temporal terms, in finite and mortal terms. There is no such thing as a beginning or a middle or an end. There is the state of activity, the entire universal process, the visible and the invisible universe included, and there is the state of quiescence, the meaning of the word Sabbath, if you like. Now, our consciousness is the key, is the sort of linchpin, the key point for transcendence to realize its own transcendence as man, as the creative thinker, the creative word. We are the embodied word. And it is for man so to live and so to purify his psyche and release himself into that state where pure mind, the divine mind, the energy of that flows freely into him and through him over the world. And this is how man can become a benediction to the world in which he lives. His very presence means the presence of the divine in the world as such. Hence, to live humanly, we have to appreciate that the process of our whole spiritual development consists in a transformation and ultimately a transmutation of our mode of awareness of existence, of our existence, of the existence of the total reality. When that transformation reaches its peak point, the unity with the divine is accomplished. Jesus said, I and my Father are one. The Hindus say Pratyagatma and Paramatma are one. When the great teachers use the word I, Aham in India, I in the English language, that I does not represent I as you or I use it. We mean this separate psychophysical organism by the word I, and for other organisms we say you, he or she, don't we? That is how we use that word. But when the perfected Holy One, who has completely transcended all selfness and become united with the totality, says the word I, it's the one and only I am, which is the totality. An example of this comes in the Old Testament in a wonderful way. You know how when Moses is in the wilderness and he suddenly, by the burning bush, and he asks the question, what shall I say to the Israelites when they ask me, who has sent you? And the answer comes in no uncertain terms, Ehiye Asher Ehiye. That Ehiye is the exact correspondent of the Indian Aham, the I am, the one and only I am. There is no separate I. All others have become the one and only I am. This separate I has become the one without losing its own individuality as long as the psychophysical organism exists. So you see, the lesser individuality has merged in perfect relationship, it's not lost, but it's in perfect relationship with the supreme individuality. And so this Ehiye, Asher Ehiye, I am that I am. That is to say, Moses receives the divine authority to say those things, to say what he had to say and do what he had to do. And you see, therefore, the importance of consciousness in all this. And one begins to live humanly then. Now let me come back to the full meaning of the word human. The prefix hu corresponds to the prefix su in Pali or Sanskrit, which means happy. The Buddha, for example, was called the Sugata, he who had gone happily to the ultimate fruition, the ultimate fulfillment. Sugata, he who has gone happily. You see? So, human, and man means, therefore, to create, the word which is the creative word. That is the thought in the mind of God. Man. And we have our English word mind, we have the Sanskrit term manas, meaning mind. We are the sons of mind, sons and daughters of mind, if you like. That is what distinguishes us from mosquitoes and ants and tigers and cats and whatnot. You see? Mind. So the creative mind, the happy creator. Now you see the implication in that. We ascribe the creative power to God, to the ultimate, to the divine. But that creative power can also manifest through the living individual, as it did in terms of the great teachers, the founders of the religions, and the truly great spiritual beings who lived on this globe. And there have been many, but their names are not known. I think I've said enough this morning.